Clause number 1321-280CR, Devin Keith DeBord versus the State of Texas.
Good morning. May it please the court. Chief Justice Contreras, Justice Benavides, and Justice Tijerina, Mr. Messinger. My name is Aaron Diaz, and I, along with Cynthia Orr and John Gilmore, represent the appellant in this matter, Devin DeBord. Before I begin, I do want to thank the court for bearing with us these past few months. We appreciate the court's flexibility and for permitting us to proceed with oral arguments today. The first issue I'm going to address this morning is the sufficiency of the evidence, followed by the judicial bias arguments raised in our briefing. I'm also happy to address any issues the court feels are dispositive to this appeal. The state indicted Mr. DeBord and his cousin Christopher with capital murder. The two were also charged with unauthorized use of a motor vehicle and theft of a firearm. The state ended up abandoning those cases before Mr. DeBord's trial. Christopher did plead guilty to murder with the possibility of parole and began serving his sentence to approximately 9 months before Mr. DeBord's trial. A jury ultimately convicted Mr. DeBord of the lesser included offense of felony murder. Initially, the state had theorized that Mr. DeBord and Christopher had went on a burglary spree that morning, intending to steal items to resell them for drug money. According to the state, the two drove Christopher's wife's Pontiac to the first residence, which was Mr. Cooley's residence, where Christopher alone stole Mr. Cooley's Jeep and a firearm he found in a shed next to his home. Thereafter, Mr. DeBord followed Christopher.
Mr. Diaz, I'm going to interrupt you because I really want to get, when you talk about the legal sufficiency, I really want to talk about what the state needed to prove as to what your client knew at the time. In the state's argument in their briefs, they say should have anticipated and cited the Nava versus state. What exactly does the state needed to prove as to their knowledge? Because I think that's what the whole case centers around. What did Mr. DeBord know when Chris went into the home of the victim on that?
Right, I apologize. Yes, the argument is whether the conspiracy theory under Texas Penal Code 7.02B should also have been included in the jury charge because, again, in this case, it was only 7.02A, A2. And so under the conspiracy theory, the state was required to prove that Mr. DeBord, that all the conspirators are guilty of the felony actually committed, though having no intent to commit that. If the felony was committed in furtherance of an unlawful purpose, and he should have anticipated that murder would occur. And so, as they did point out in Georgia v. State, the Court of Criminal Appeals held that murder should not always be anticipated in the course of committing the conspiracy in this case. And so they were.
Are you saying that he could not have expected a murder to take place when he knew he had already stolen a firearm?
Well, per George, a co-conspirator. Co-conspirators should not always anticipate that a murder would occur from the conspiracy. Now, if there was some evidence tending to show that he could have or should have anticipated that a murder would occur, then I think it would suffice in that matter. But here,
does the mere fact that he now knows that his co-conspirator, as we'll call him this morning, had a firearm lead us to the should have anticipated? That's sufficient when you have
certainly
a co-conspirator, because that's what the whole thing. He now has a gun. He didn't start the morning with a gun or the day of. I don't remember what time of the day it was. But isn't that sufficient legal sufficiency to for this jury under should have anticipated?
Well, you're correct, Justice Benavides, that they did not leave that morning with a firearm. Christopher stole it from Mr. Cooley's residence. When Christopher left Mr. Cooley's residence in the blue Jeep, he tailed it out of there. Christopher, with little gas, drove out following him to the decedent's property, which There was testimony that it's about a four-minute drive from Mr. Cooley's residence to the Tucker's residence. And so when he got to the Tucker's residence, there was no evidence that he actually went in to the property. And so there was testimony that from the gate to the home was quite some distance. And so for him to have known that Christopher, having just stole somebody's Jeep, would use that Jeep to go through another property on his own, get down, grab a firearm, whether he knew it was loaded or not. I mean, that's another issue. But at any rate, whether he knew that Christopher would get down, grab that gun, enter somebody's property when he had no idea where Christopher was even going to begin with.
Well, I understand that that is how Mr. Dubord says the activities occurred that morning. But the statement of Chris, which is a part of the evidence of this record, kind of lays out a whole different, that they had a whole conversation about it. And the jury is at liberty to believe and not to believe any testimony. If they just take the statement of Chris, not his testimony, which he ended up giving to the court, is it that sufficient then to do the should have anticipated? And they can disregard the rest of the testimony.
Well, our argument in the briefing is that because Christopher was an accomplice witness, he should have, the jury wasn't permitted just to rely on his testimony as a co-conspirator. Now, the jury charge didn't characterize Christopher as an accomplice witness in this case, and so they were instructed to do so. And so if we consider the other evidence outside of Christopher's, there really wasn't anything to show that there was a conspiracy to burgle anybody that morning. And
what about the Facebook postings?
The Facebook postings involved a mask that they tried to show that this was part of what they were going to do that day. Of course, there was no mask found in the vehicles when they were arrested. And Mr. DeBoer testified about that. It was just something that they were doing that morning for fun. And so the argument is, even assuming that there was an agreement that they would maybe go to Mr. Cooley's residence, there was nothing to show that he aided, at least as under the first party liability, that he aided Christopher commit the subsequent crimes. And so he was unaware of what Christopher was
actually. I think the state argues on the aided, and I was somewhat confused about the testimony as I read the statements and parts of that record as to the gate and the moving. My understanding is that the home of the victim had some sort of gate. Again, a little mm-hmm. confused by what the testimony was, that it was stated that Mr. DeBoer then moved, somehow helped open the gate. I don't know if it's backwards or forwards, and I know there's a dispute over it. But isn't that sufficient then to suffice the abated portion of this verdict?
I don't believe so, because he would have had to also have the intent not only to for the burglary, but also the result of the underlying felony, which was the felony murder, which was murdering the decedent. And I don't think there's any evidence in the record that shows that he intended the result of that. Simply by pushing a gate open that was closed when he stayed behind at the front of the gate, of course, it closed, and Christopher went on his own volition down the road yards away to the decedent's property and went in there on his own. And then when he came back, the gate was locked, and so they still had no communication at this point. You know, they hadn't spoken from Mr. Cooley's residence to the decedent's residence here. And so Mr. DeBoer saw the gate was locked, and so he nudged it with the Pontiac. Again, they didn't speak at that point until they got to the church later, which was, I'm assuming, a couple minutes after that. They drove to a church where they discussed what he had just done, and they parted ways at that point. Mr. DeBoer didn't want to do anything. And so if we look at before, during, and after the crime to show whether there is a sufficient evidence for a party liability, I don't believe that none of that shows that he aided or assisted or conspired with Christopher to commit these crimes.
I'd like to go back to the statement, Christopher DeBoard's statement, because it is inconsistent with that that you've just said. And you mentioned that it's accomplice witness testimony that should not be considered. But the state has argued that it's an out-of-court statement. And so the rule that you are referring to doesn't apply in that the Article 38.14 contemplates evidence adduced in open court by live witnesses under oath. So they're arguing that this statement does not fall under that rule. How do you respond to that? And so that it's properly considered. And in fact, I don't think you guys have made much of an argument in your brief against this statement.
Not so much. Again, that statement wouldn't have come in for other issues raised in our brief, of course. But at any rate, that statement was going to be used to impeach Christopher during his testimony, and so we'd argue that it, in essence, is a part of his oral testimony because they're going back and forth using that statement and trying to impeach him. Of course, he didn't he cut off his answering at a certain point, but did come back, and that statement was again used by Mr. Wilson, the defense lawyer in this case, to against him. And so we would argue that it at least the written statement is an extension of his oral testimony provided during the trial.
Such that the rule would apply.
Yes.
Okay.
And didn't Mr. DeBoard, the appellant, testify?
He did.
Okay.
Yes.
And so then the accomplice witness rule only applies if it can't be corroborated, correct?
Certainly.
Okay, and then so the jury could, as Justice Benavidez said, choose to believe or not believe certain things, certain people, and certain of others. So some of the things that, according to your brief, some of the things that the appellant says are very closely related to what Christopher says.
Right. Well, as far as what they set out to do that morning, Christopher, I believe, argued that they were going to commit these crimes, I believe, from his initial statement, because at that point he had thought that Mr. DeBoard had gone against him during the first interrogation. At any rate, Mr. DeBoard did state during his testimony at trial that he was set to get a $50,000 check in royalties the next day. Christopher stated that he knew somebody who was going to give them free drugs. Mr. DeBoard, not being a drug dealer, was intending on using whatever drugs they were going to get that morning. And Christopher stated he didn't know what Christopher was going to do. But at any rate, the address that they were going to go to that morning ended up being somewhere way across, miles away from wherever Christopher thought the original address was. And so, according to Mr. DeBoard, he didn't set out that morning to go burglarize anybody. They were low on gas and realized that they needed to travel a lengthier distance than they thought they had to that morning. And so they were trying to get gas, per Mr. DeBoard. And so with the remainder of my time, I would like to address at least the second and third issues regarding the judicial bias claims that we've raised. And specifically, there are, or the state has raised the preservation issue. They're concerned about the preservation. But our position is that the due process violation we've raised falls within the first or second rights discussed in the Court of Criminal Appeals Marin decision, either an absolute right or non-forfeitable rights. In Proenza, the court did hold that 38.05, at least as a statutory right, fell within the second category of waiver-only rights, and that that are not forfeited by failing to object at trial and can be raised for the first time on appeal. Whether the claim of judicial bias or impartiality is raised as a statutory right under 38.05 or a constitutional due process violation, the purpose of both rights are the same, that the defendant receive a fair trial by an impartial court without the scales tipping in one favor. So there's, at least in this situation, there should not have been an objection required in order to preserve it. And I see that my time has expired.
Well, let me, can I ask just a sure. really quick? So I'm trying to ascertain how, what is the standard that we have to decide of the bias of the court in over, that it becomes so effectuate the judgment of this court?
Well, as the court held in Marin, or sorry, Proenza, that at least that right was under, or concerns about judicial commentary that rise to this level should fall under at least two, which is a non-forfeitable right. And so there was nothing, he didn't need to object unless it was expressly waived.
But aside from the waiver, once we get past the waiver, and let's say there's preservation, what is the review of to the bias of the judge in order to actually reverse a verdict?
I understand. So at least one court, the fourth court hold in Aptica Perova, that such an error, at least the ex parte communications, was structural and no harm analysis was required. And so that would be our
argument. So we don't have to do a harm, you believe we don't have to do a harm analysis?
No.
Thank you. You'll have your remaining time for rebuttal. Mr. Messinger, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'll start with the second issue and then move back. It sounds like the court's got a pretty good handle on the sufficiency issue, and then I'll be happy to talk about whatever y'all want to talk about. Starting with preservation, even though it's not framed as such, I don't have a big problem with addressing this global issue as a motion for a new trial review. Part of the problem with Proenza is that it's a very limited ruling. It dealt with a mandatory statute. Some of the reasoning gets into why it might not be effective or desirable to try to object whenever you think the trial court has done something untoward. I disagreed with it. I argued Proenza. I disagreed with it. Presiding Judge Keller, I think, summarized what I had to say about that, because I think the trial court should be given an opportunity to explain something not only to the parties but to the jury if it happens in front of them. Be that as it may, that's part of the reasoning of it, but the holding of Proenza is based around a mandatory statute. So to whatever extent some of the complaints in this case deal with improper comments under 3805, it would not need to be preserved, and you could deal with those on a smaller basis. But in order to preserve a global complaint, I think you'd have to go to the motion for new trial ruling. And frankly, when you're not, I don't think he's able to look at any one ruling or event and say, this is what made this judge clearly biased or partial. So he's going to have to say, well, looking backwards, we can see that this is what happened.
What about the ex parte? I mean, we all know that there was an ex parte that occurred. And before you answer that question, do you agree that we don't have to do a harm analysis, that if we find bias by the court, that's sufficient to reverse, or do we have to do some kind of harm analysis? That's what I'm...
Once you get to the point where you've decided that the standard of bias or partiality is met, I don't know how you would ever do a harm analysis.
Right.
I know what they're alleging is not quite the Toomey versus Ohio bias or partiality that is on the list of structural errors, but I don't know how you would do a harm analysis there if you hit that point. The problem is we're miles away from that point. The foundation for their claim is this ex parte conversation.
Right.
And I think it's worth noting that we know about the ex parte conversation because as soon as it wrapped up and everybody was in front of the judge again, that's the first thing he said is, hey, this conversation happened. And you can tell, as much as you can from reading a cold record, you can look at it, and the judge says it as though, I have nothing to hide. Like, why should I be bothered by this? And the way the conversation unfolds, it seems, I think in the record can be fairly read to show a judge who didn't think anything of it. It was a matter that had nothing to do with opposing counsel. At the first opportunity, he disclosed it to opposing counsel. And then he got a highly charged, in his opinion, objection, which then led to some other comments. But in terms of the ex parte conversation on its own, the best you could possibly alleged is that this was, you know, creative plan was the phrasing that was used in the motion for new trial and the motion to recuse. The best you could say is that at some point in the process, the judge was thinking, perhaps I can force Christopher to testify. The problem is Christopher pled, while he didn't have an agreement that was to testify, and his plea agreement was not contingent upon that, he did say he was going to testify truthfully. The state didn't call him because they thought he was going to show up and put a lie to their theory of the case. They thought he was going to testify consistently with his sworn statement from the previous August. So nobody was trying to force Christopher to testify. Christopher was there to testify. The state was there to take his testimony. And had Christopher not switched anything, that's what would have happened. But the claim that the judge forced Christopher to testify without proper warnings, he didn't force Christopher to testify.
I tend to disagree, and I know that we read the record cold, but as Judge Bell is telling him in the record, I'm going to keep throwing you in jail. I'm going to bring you back every day, and I'm going to add 6 months. And that doesn't have anything to do with your life because you're entitled to parole, but you're going to serve out however many times I hold you in contempt. And by the way, the state can take back their plea and try you for capital murder, and they're putting the death penalty back. There's some force going on, sir, you know, of making them testify. So I'm not sure that the judge wasn't trying. Wrong or not wrong, I'm not getting into that. He was trying to force Chris to testify and tell him that he could not plead the fifth.
From the judge's point of view, what he understood was, I'm not a snitch. That's what he understood Christopher to be saying, because that's what Christopher, in fact, said the first day.
Right. He said, I'm not a snitch. I don't want to be a snitch.
Okay. So if the judge, and if you take the judge at his word, state expects Christopher to testify. Christopher says, no, I'm taking the fifth. The judge says, well, you already pled guilty to that. You're not going to expose yourself to any liability for this crime. So what he's saying is, you're going to get immunity because you can't be prosecuted anymore. So if you're not going to testify, you're going to be held in contempt. That's what should happen. So the fact that there are consequences for doing things you're not supposed to do in a trial court doesn't remove your agency.
I was just taking note I disagree that the court wasn't forcing him to testify.
I'm trying to get into
a discussion with you about it. If I was a trial judge, which I'm not, I would have had his lawyer come in. You have a lawyer, right? Get your lawyer in here. Your lawyer can explain your consequences to you if you decide not to testify. With that being said, I agree with the portion that it looks like the judge was just the state was in the courtroom, the defense wasn't in there. He's having a conversation with the state about what we're going to do about Chris and his not willing. And then when the defense walks in, he tells them, hey, we were just having this conversation. I do agree that that's what it looks like occurred from the record.
And I do agree with you that contempt is a serious thing, and that should influence your decision to testify. The question would be whether or not the contempt order was just or not. And as the judge saw it, if you're saying you don't want to testify because, for generic Fifth Amendment reasons, I don't want to expose myself to a murder conviction, well, that ship sailed last fall, so you will be held in contempt because you got called and you have to testify if there's no Fifth Amendment reason for you not to.
He's already doing his life sentence, correct?
And that's part of the problem, is that a lot of the other advice and conversation that happens about whether or not the plea can be withdrawn and undone, it's a remedy problem that the state has, but it's not a he has the right not to testify for that reason problem.
So he's pled, and there's a judgment been signed, and so was the judge incorrect in telling him that we're going to withdraw your plea and then subject you?
And that part was incorrect, and even later on, because the way it's framed, I don't think he's trying to be cute about it. He says, you know, the state has informed me that they will seek to withdraw your plea. That's maybe factually true, even if it's not legally possible. And then later on, he says, as he's getting down to the rest of the warnings, look, I don't know. Maybe this can be undone. Maybe it can't be. I don't know. But here's why we're here today. Here's what you have to do. You have to testify for both people. You're not going to come up and testify a little bit and then not for the state or in whatever order. So all of this happens, and still some of the background information is incorrect in terms of potential consequences. But you also have to remember that at this point, and it's interesting, you read it through the record through the first time chronologically, and things develop, and you say, well, this is unfortunate, and I wonder why this happened this way. But then you get to the end, and you get to the defense counsel cross-examining him, and you find out, cross-examining Christopher, and you find out, oh, back on day one when Christopher first showed up, before the ex parte conversation was had and revealed, you spoke to him. I'm not saying anybody put in anybody's ear, but when you go back and you read defense counsel, say, the morning of the ex parte revelation, oh, maybe he's afraid of perjuring himself. We don't know. Maybe I should ask him. And you begin to wonder whether or not he was asked the day before. Because, again, Christopher shows up the first day. He says, I'm not a snitch. I'm not testifying in favor of the state. I'm not a snitch. And that's all he says. And then he comes back the second day, and it really isn't until, I think it's the second day, and then again after he gets sent out of the courtroom again and defense attorney speaks to him a second time, that he comes back and he's very well explained as to why everything he said in his plea statement was untrue, and he would hate to perjure himself, but he's a man, and he knows the code of the streets and all the other stuff that defense counsel goes through. So while there are things that the trial court got wrong in terms of the admonition, the backstory of what the trial court's not aware of until after all the rulings were made, it puts a different slant on everything. So if the allegation, as I think the allegation has to be, that the judge conspired with the state to force testimony, well, if the testimony wasn't forced and Christopher didn't testify for the state, then you have an allegation of an attempt that went nowhere. And it's a very not smart attempt, because as soon as they tried to get it done, they disclosed it. So I don't, looking at this record, I don't know how you see a real scheme between the judge and the state. You can see mistakes, but they're promptly disclosed, and just based on that, I don't see how you build everything from that. In terms of the other claims, because the ex parte, I don't see is going anywhere once you really look at everything in context. You have a bunch of rulings that are well within the judge's abuse of discretion, the admission of the Facebook. I mean, what strikes you when you look at the record, and I was rereading everything the last couple days, the reply brief from appellant alludes to, it doesn't discuss, but alludes to things like the trial court interrupted the state only twice during voir dire, but interrupted defense counsel 9 times. Well, if that's all you had is that stat, it would be curious, and you might want to go look at it. When you go look at it, you find out that what the judge does is every time defense counsel seems to be lining up a question for a strike for cause, the judge wants the question asked his way. And so most of the interruptions, that's what it is. And so the judge, I think from the record, is clearly trying to avoid the one party asked questions that seem to be sort of disqualifying, but maybe not quite. And then the state comes back and asks to rehabilitate, and you go back and forth, and we've all read these records. And then, so when you look at it, and in case by case, the judge is just trying to make sure the proper legal standard is enunciated. Whether or not he should have let defense counsel have a crack at it, I can't say. But when you get down to the strikes for cause, the judge is more than willing to strike anybody the parties want stricken. So, again, you can say that the defense counsel got interrupted more during voir dire, but you can't say that anything in the record shows the judge was not trying to be more than accommodating to make sure both sides felt like they had a fair jury. The conversation over the Facebook photo is like that. You can look at it and say, well, there's more conversation, and the judge tried to explain to the state what they needed to do to get the thing in. But the first thing that happens when there's an objection is the trial court cuts the state off and doesn't let it do the normal things you would do to get some testimony outside the record, whatever, to bring it in. Then the judge stops, says, hey, just so you all know, this is why I made my ruling the way it is. And then you have, I think, 9 pages in the record where he's explaining himself. He wants to make sure both parties know why he's making the ruling he's making. And it's through that process that a hearsay objection becomes the objection that opposing counsel is making on appeal. So, I mean, again, the record's not perfect. And there are lots of unflattering ways that you can look at any of the comments the trial court made in isolation, and they would be fair on this cold record. But to say that this record shows anything like someone, a defendant who could not get in there and get a fair trial, there's just nothing in the record to hang your hat on. And if this record were to become an example of that, I'm not sure what you would do. I mean, the techie from the Supreme Court is pretty clear about the fact that an annoyance, intemperance about rulings, a little personal back and forth, these are things that we wish people, when they ascend to the bench, could transcend their humanity. It doesn't happen. But there's nothing flagrant here.
Let me ask you about Christopher's statement. I'm still stuck on this. You say in your brief, the most damning evidence came from Christopher's plea statement in his case, which was read to the jury and entered into evidence. If the accomplice witness rule does apply to the statement, as has been argued by the appellant, what else is there?
Oh, of course, I disagree that it applies, but I think Justice Tijerina is right. I mean, normally we have a situation where the defendant doesn't testify, an accomplice does, and because we're dealing with the on-the-stand testimony of the accomplice, we need to find some way to corroborate that. Appellant did testify. Appellant testifies to all these different aspects. So, I mean, you have some, obviously his story is different than the letter, and Christopher's testimony, his story is different from his plea letter. But in between, you have somebody who not only puts him there, but explains that, you know, all the core details are there. You know, we did go to this first house. We did steal a Jeep. There was a firearm stolen. We went to a second place. And he can say, well, I didn't go in at this point, but now you're doing a series of burglaries. And if he wants to say, this will dovetail in with the sufficiency, if he wants to say, gosh, after we burgled this first place and then we went on to the second person's property, I had no idea what was going on in there. It just doesn't make any sense. And this is a detail that I left out of my brief, and I apologize. I'm not sure that we're arguing that 702B is not the proper test. I heard opposing counsel answer your questions as though that was the test and then kind of sink back into an aiding and encouraging with a requisite intent sort of situation. I will insist that B is the proper test. I think Judge Cochran's concurrence in Nava explains it better than I could.
I thought I heard Diaz say that A was what was submitted to the jury, though.
Oh, it's definitely submitted, but with the sufficiency, we're going with the hypothetically correct. I mean, same thing. The accomplice witness rule was submitted because the jury had the option of taking some of Christopher's trial testimony, but that doesn't bind us to complying with it even when we don't have to. And that's the situation. One of the things I overlooked, even from the defendant's testimony, he takes the stand on the trial, and he says, you know, Christopher had the gun. He went back towards Mr. Cooley's house. This is the first house where he stole the rifle and they stole the Jeep. And then I see Christopher leveling the rifle, and I can't see what he's pointing it at. And I had to run out, and I had to put the, you know, the barrel of the rifle down and ask him, dude, what are you doing? Like, what's going on? Have you lost it? Appellant testifies, and he said earlier in the day when they were all doing a bunch of drugs that Christopher thinks he's talking on the phone, but he's just talking to his hand. And I miss these. These are cute stories as you go through, just as a, hey, this is how high we were when we made bad decisions that day. But when you get to the point where you're sitting lookout, and it's the second burglary, and now it's not a shop building, now it's a habitation, and it's Sunday morning, and you're sending somebody into the house, or you're being lookout while someone else goes into the house, someone who you know pointed rifles at who knows what 5 minutes earlier, he takes the rifle into the house. The idea that he shouldn't have anticipated what was going to happen, that stretches credulity. And that's why, what Judge Cochran said is correct, I think we'd be in pretty decent shape if this were intent-based, but we don't have to go intent. This is just completely from an objective reasonableness standpoint. Would an ordinary person have said, especially in the context of felony murder, is this somebody who could commit an act clearly dangerous while in the course of committing a burglary? And the answer is clearly yes. So, you know, with the proper standard, looking at all the evidence in the proper light, the sufficiency of the evidence is pretty plain. I'm happy to address any of the other points.
Any other questions?
No.
All right, thank you very much.
We'll take the time back. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Diaz, you have your remaining 5 minutes.
Thank you. I do want to point out a few things regarding the issue two and issue three and the ex parte communications. And Leiteke, or Leiteke, the Supreme Court did state that judicial remarks made during trial that are critical or disapproving of or hostile to counsel or the parties or their case will rise to the level of bias or partiality if those actions reveal such a high degree of favoritism or antagonism as to make fair judgment impossible. And I know the opposing counsel did point out to maybe instances that we've mentioned in, or a couple of instances mentioned in our brief throughout the trial that we believe, at least in addition to the ex parte communications, cumulatively showed the bias or impartiality argument that we're making. I don't want to belabor every single point, but I do want to point out a few instances, especially towards regarding the ex parte communication, and that is that what that day that the judge came back and notified the parties of the ex parte communications, this is where Mr. Wilson did object and attempt to make a record, but which was not well received. That same day, the trial court accused Mr. Wilson of trying to ex parte, but that didn't go anywhere because the state acknowledged being present during that communication. Later, when Mr. Wilson was cross-examining Christopher, there was an exchange where the state objected, stating counsel is testifying relevance. The trial court replied, yes, he is. The objection will be, Mr. Wilson stated, that's fine, and the judge continued, no, no, I'm sustaining the objection, Mr. Wilson, if you'll let me do a little bit of my job. This shows the exact issues that objecting at every single instance during a trial where you or defense counsel might think the judge is being one-sided, this is the precise situation that that could come from that. And so the last point I do want to make about the ex parte communications is that the record is unclear about why the trial court was invested and intervened between the state and its witness, and why it was necessary to threaten Christopher with stacked contempt charges in order to compel Christopher's testimony, to the point of having to think it over overnight and talk to appellate counsel before coming back and making that decision. And so it was only after that communication that Christopher ended up testifying, because again, he was still the state's witness at that point, and he was later cross-examined by Mr. Wilson. The last thing I'd like to say is that the state did point out in its brief that Mr. DeBoer did not receive a perfect trial, and we're not arguing that he was entitled to a perfect trial, but he was at least entitled to a fair one. And ultimately, our position is that that didn't happen here. And for decades, courts have urged courts to avoid impressing the jury with its personal views of the case before them, which would affect their deliberations. And because jurors are prone to seize with alacrity upon the conduct or language of the trial judge, which may interpret as shedding light on their view of the evidence. And so today should be no different. With that said, and if there's no further questions, we'd respectfully ask the court to reverse based on the insufficiency of the evidence, or alternatively, that this case be remanded for a new trial based on issues two and three. And the court has nothing further.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. The case will be under submission.